Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Welcome to the RTC Weekly Download. I'm your host, Jim Dolan, and we have some different material for you this week to listen to. We're going to start off with science fiction. It's called Exploring Tomorrow. This is called The First Man on the Moon, and it's from 1958, so this was only about 10 years before the actual event occurred in reality. After that, we'll have guest star, an episode with Frank Sinatra singing, and we'll have an episode of The Hedda Hopper Show with guest Agnes Moorehead. So lots of good listening coming up. Stay with us.
The program you are about to hear is fiction, science fiction. We make no guarantees, however, how long it will remain fiction.
Exploring Tomorrow. Now, here is your guide to these adventures of the mind, the editor of Astounding Science Fiction magazine, John Campbell, Jr.
The scene is a missile testing base somewhere in the continental United States. The time? 2:30 on a Tuesday afternoon, 5, maybe 10 years from now. A rather unusual missile is getting worked over. Blast off is 10 minutes away, and the countdown is in its last stages. And a man is sitting inside this missile, waiting. The United States is about to make its first attempt to send a manned rocket to the moon.
9 minutes to blast off, Captain. Still feel loose and easy?
Like a bird, Colonel, waiting to be cut loose and sore. How do you feel?
Me, Captain? I'm just sitting here in the observation tower. You're the one in the launching pad. You're the man going to the moon.
And you're the one who has to face all the reporters after blastoff. Me, I'm glad I'll be up there alone. How much time left, Colonel?
6 minutes, 20 seconds. Let's run through the schedule one last time.
Okay. I sit in this cradle and I wait for the rockets to toss me up into space. I get 500 seconds of 4G acceleration. Then I sit around and look out the viewport for the next 4 days while the ship coasts in 0G free fall. I'm roughly 8 1/4 minutes past 4. On Sunday afternoon, the autopilot is going to turn the rocket engines on again, long enough to land me in the Oceanus Procellarum, which better be as dry as the Palomar boys say it is. I climb into my little Jim Dandy spacesuit, wander around the moon for a while, take some snapshots, pick up a couple of rocks as souvenirs. And 13 hours after landing, I get back into my ship and I come home. Did I leave anything out?
Not a thing, Captain. 3 minutes, 10 seconds.
Well, all I do is sit here and wait anyway. Computer down below in the belly of the ship does all the work. Me, Mike Wellman, first man on the moon. Maybe, anyway.
What do you mean, maybe? The ship's been tested thoroughly. There's no possibility of...
A blow-up? No, go ahead. Don't be afraid to say it. I wasn't talking about that. The odds are pretty good that this bird is going to get me there. Only thing I'm wondering about is whether someone else is going to get there ahead of me. I'd hate to find a big vodka party going on when I get there.
90 seconds. They're clearing the launching pad, Captain. We better break contact now. Good luck. The next time I hear from you, it's going to be from space.
Sure, Colonel. I'll report as soon as I'm in free fall. Then radio messages every 4 hours. You won't forget about those baseball scores, will you?
Scores. 30 seconds, Captain. And all America is rooting for you.
And I'm rooting for the Dodgers. So long, Colonel. See you next week when I get back.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, mark.
Are you reading me, launching base? How do I come in?
Clear and sharp, Captain.
Oh, glad to hear it. Okay, ship's time, 1,452 hours. Blastoff went fine from this end. I got through acceleration good enough. 4G's isn't much fun, but I don't mind it in 8-minute stretches. The ship's in free fall now, no gravity at all. And it's weird, all right. Even after all those hours in the training chamber, I still feel a little strange. Very quiet up here. Nice. Man really can think here. And the view is really something. Where do you see the photos?
How about the psychological reaction? You don't feel cut off?
Me? A guy whose idea of heaven is being alone with some books? Colonel, I like it up here. The psych test said I was an introvert, didn't they?
Well, not really. Just sort of solitary-minded.
Same thing. Well, it's us solitary-minded people who are going to be your spacemen, Colonel. We don't mind the loneliness. Listen, Colonel, how are the cosmic ray readings coming through?
Perfect. All the equipment seems to be functioning.
Including the pilot. Or rather, the live cargo, because that's all I really am. Okay, Colonel, I got a few odd jobs to do on board. I'll be talking to you again in 4 hours. Over. Here I am again, Colonel. 2 days out, still no sweat. I'm getting used to this no-gravity business. And I
go on with the rest of the report, Captain. There's been a change in the operational plans.
Huh? What kind of change?
You want landing on the moon. Pentagon orders are for you to adjust the computer to alternate course B. Circle the moon and return to Earth without landing.
Hey, wait a minute, sir. How come the switch?
Well, it's an awkward situation, Captain. You see, between the time I last spoke to you and now, the Russians... I know this will come as kind of a shock to you. The Russians made a successful landing on the moon.
No!
Radio Moscow announced it 2 hours ago. And since then, we've picked up broadcasts from the Russian ship. They've landed, all right.
They beat us to it. By 2 stinking days, 2 days earlier, and I would have been the first.
You haven't heard the worst part of it yet. The Russians have claimed the moon.
They what?
Like Columbus claiming the Western Hemisphere. We're putting up a yell, of course, but there just isn't any precedent for this kind of thing. The UN is meeting to decide whether they have any right to.
So this is why I can't land, huh?
The Russians say they'll regard any lunar landing as trespassing on their property. We can't risk an incident, of course. So for the time being, we're going to hold back and wait till the legal aspect of this business is worked out.
So I can't land. They send me up here and I ride around for a week and don't even put my foot down on the moon. Uh-uh, Colonel. Russia doesn't own the moon, no matter what they say.
Captain Woman.
I'm sorry, Colonel. I'm more than halfway there, and I'm darned if I'm going to miss my chance. I'm going to land, sir.
Well, then, listen to me. You can't disobey orders.
Yes, I can, sir. I'm landing. Over and out.
It's not that the moon wasn't meant for man. It's just that man was never designed for the moon. It's a fantastically inhospitable place. Harsh, blinding sunlight with no atmosphere to dim it. Jagged shadows. The rocks are hard, sharp-edged. There has been no weathering to soften them, and the shadows are just as hard and black. It's not a nice place to be alone. Or even when there's only one other human being within 200,000 miles.
I don't know if you want to hear from me again, Colonel, but I'm beaming this anyway. Look, I just wanted to let you know that I've landed on the moon as originally scheduled. Yeah, right on the nose, in the designated landing area. Northern branch of the Oceanus Procellarum. And you can tell the Palomar fellas that they were right all along. Maybe this was an ocean once, but not in the last million years or so. As for the Russian ship, it isn't any hoax. I saw it when I came down. It's about 50 miles north of here. Maybe later I'll break out the rocket sled and wander over there for some vodka. The Russians are trying to contact me now. I better shift channel and see what they want. Over, Colonel. Come on in, Ivan.
Да, нет, товарищ, ничего.
I'm afraid that uses up my Russian vocabulary, Ivan. How's your English?
I am Captain Dmitry Novikov, Solid Space Forces. You are illegally trespassing on our property, American.
I am, huh? Say, your English is pretty good, but your politics isn't.
You say the moon is yours, huh? Lunar Soviet Socialist Republic? I'm sorry to disagree. Just getting here first doesn't give you the right to claim the whole place, you know.
The matter has been considered by our legal experts. We have established prior claim. I am under orders to request you to leave Russian territory immediately.
But this is cockeyed, claiming the whole moon. Now, look here, Dmitry, let
you will address me as Captain Novikov.
Okay, now look here, Novikov. The moon's a big place, and there's room for a lot of us up here. It really isn't fair to want to hog the whole thing yourself.
The Presidium said Soviet policy, not space pilots. I'm instructed to warn you that you are trespassing. I do not wish to debate the matter with you.
So I'm trespassing, then. What are you going to do about it?
My ship is armed.
And you can't figure out any better way of celebrating the conquest of space than starting a war about it?
The United States ordered you not to make a landing. They recognize our claim. We cannot tolerate violation of our rights.
And you're going to be nasty about it, I see, huh? Well, I'll take my chances. Now I've got some work to do before I go back. I'll be leaving the moon in 14 hours and a bit. Hey, now, how long are you staying up here? You've been here better than 2 days already. You planning to hold the fort forever?
My plans for departure should not concern you.
Well, I'm just curious, that's all. Okay, Dmitry. Maybe I'll be talking to you again soon. And yeah, you sneaky son of a gun, congratulations. You did get here first. Over. Come in, launching bay. Can you hear me?
We're getting you, Wilman. We read you.
Look, I just had a little chat with the Ruski. There seems to be only one of them. He gave me some malarkey about firing on me if I don't clear off the moon right away.
Wilman, you insubordinate idiot. You're liable to touch off a war over this moon trip.
Well, what was I supposed to do? Smile politely and turn back just because they got here first? You think they have any right to claim the moon?
Of course not, but that's not the point. You were ordered not to risk trouble by landing.
Yeah, and I landed anyway. Well, go ahead, chop my head off when I get back to Earth. Meanwhile, I'm here, and if that Russian doesn't blow me up, I expect to do a little exploring in the next 14 hours.
I don't think the Russian's going to blow you up. He's got his own troubles.
What do you mean?
We have decoded some of the messages he's been sending back to Moscow. Seems he made a faulty landing and has to make some repairs on his ship. It may take him a week or two, and he doesn't have enough food. Russia may be crowing about claiming the moon, but it's going to look bad for them if their spaceman can't get back.
Yeah, that would be rough. Maybe I better call him back and see if I can help him out.
Well, then leave him alone. He's a Russian.
He's a human being. And so am I. Get off the wire and let me call him, Colonel.
I order you not to make any overtures to that Russian.
Look, I'm not on Earth now. There doesn't need to be a Cold War up here, too, Colonel. And I have plenty of food to spare. Give the folks back home my love. I'm going to call Ivan again.
It's one thing to make a claim, to say, this is mine. It's something else to hold on to it and make the claim stick. Somewhat like the colonel. It was a little difficult for him to enforce the orders he was trying to give to the man on the moon.
Novikov, you getting me?
You have 3 hours to leave Russian territory. Then I must commence action.
Now, look, don't give me that stuff. I know your ship's disabled and you're in trouble.
This is untrue. My ship is in good condition.
Dan Trotsky was Rasputin's brother. You know, Novikov, I sometimes feel I'm the only sane man in a world of lunatics. Those idiots down there in Washington didn't want me to land because it might make Moscow sore. And you don't want any help from me because I'm not a good Marxist. It's a losing battle, Dmitry. Everyone seems to know what he really wants, and yet everybody tries hard to get the opposite.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay. You just sit tight. I'm going to launch the rocket sled and get over your way with a couple of cartons of provisions. If you won't take food from a lackey of Wall Street, that's your business. I'm coming over anyway.
Get that helmet off. Hello, Novikov. My name's Mike Wellman.
Why have you done this?
What trick are you playing? Listen, friend, all I'm doing is bringing some of my spare food. Nothing up my sleeve at all.
I do not understand that. Up my sleeve?
It's a decadent capitalist idiom. Means I'm not trying to fool you. The supplies are out on the rocket sled. Get into your suit and let's bag them in.
I said I would fire on you. And you bring me food?
Yeah, silly, isn't it? But they told me they picked up your messages to Moscow. That you were going to be stuck here a few weeks for repairs.
I was not telling the truth.
Hmm?
This ship will never take off again. The rear rocket tubes are hopelessly crumpled. The fuel field lines are severed. It was a very poor landing. I gave incorrect data to the computer.
And you told them you could fix it?
They do not like to receive news of failure. Leave me alone, American. Take your food and go away.
Hey, what are you going to eat? Rocks? There won't be a rescue ship up here for a month, at least.
There will be no rescue ship for me. I do not deserve rescue.
You just sit up here and starve to death?
I made a faulty landing. I cannot return to my country now.
And I disobeyed orders. I wasn't supposed to land because the moon is red property now. But the only Russian here is stranded, helpless.
Do not mock me.
I'm not. There's a fine bunch of spacemen you and me are. You smash up your ship and I disobey half my orders. But I'm glad I disobeyed anyway. At least there'll be one practical result of my trip. I'll be saving a man's life.
You?
Sure. You're coming back with me to Earth. We can jettison some of the meters and stuff and make room for you. I bet you don't weigh more than 150. We can manage.
Sure.
But save the butts for later. And if you try to argue me out of it, I'll slug you. Hello, Colonel. I'm on my way home. Pretty fair blast off, and we're 20,000 miles out from the moon now. Oh, I left a little of the equipment behind. The next ship can pick it up. And I've got a passenger.
You mean that Russian?
Yeah. Seems the ship was wrecked, so I talked him into coming back with me. He's down back in the galley fixing lunch now. I guess we'll both be called traitors for saying it, but we've sort of become friends. And he doesn't think Russia ought to claim the moon either.
Well, we have one distinction anyway. Maybe a Russian ship was the first to get to the moon, but it was an American one that made the first successful round trip.
I like to think of it in a different way. Not an American ship or a Russian ship. Stuff like that shouldn't matter anymore. Call it a ship from Earth. Yeah. Novikov and I started out separately, but we're coming back together. The first expedition from Earth to Moon is coming home.
To man, of course. To mankind. You know, Earth is really a twin planet. No other planet we know of has a moon that's practically as big as the planet itself. The moon is Earth's smaller sister. And it, like the Earth, belongs to man. We earned it. We worked for it. For 3 billions of years. We have been evolving and struggling and growing. The next growth is out to the moon. We're on our way.
From January 22nd, 1958, that's Exploring Tomorrow and First Man on the Moon. And listening to that, it sounds like it's word for word what happened up there, so they're good at predicting things. Coming up next on the show this week is Frank Sinatra, starring in a program called Guest Star, and I believe this is one of those programs that the government ran that was selling bonds or something to that effect. We'll find out shortly anyway. This is from 1947.
The The United States Savings Bonds Division presents Guest Star. How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Les Tremaine, your host for Guest Star, a transcribed feature program brought to you each week by United States Savings Bonds and this station as a public service. It's a reminder that you can save for the future safely and profitably through the regular purchase of United States Savings Bonds. Our guest this week is one of the outstanding singers of popular songs, a man whose voice is familiar to every one of you, Frank Sinatra. He's picked a couple of fine songs for our program, which I know you'll enjoy. However, first, let's open the entertainment with a selection by the Savings Bonds Orchestra, conducted by Harry Sosnick. Mr. Sosnick's own arrangement of Love for Sale. Now, friends, our guest of the day, a man whose work on stage, screen, radio, and recordings has made him one of the greatest popular singers of our time. Accompanied by Axel Stordahl and the Hit Parade Orchestra, he opens his part in our show with a musical salute to the new year, Great Day. Here he is, Frank Sinatra.
When you're down and out, lift up your head and shout. There's gonna be a great day. Angels in the sky promise that by and by there's gonna be a great day. Gabriel will warn you some early morn. You will hear his horn, Rudy tootin', it's not far away. Hold up your hands and say, there's gonna be a great day. Gabriel will warn you some early morn. You will hear his horn. Rudy tootin', it's not far away. Hold up your hands and say, gonna be a great day.
That was swell. But you needn't think that you can get by with just one song. No, sirree. What's your next one?
Every once in a while, along comes a song that makes you feel sort of humble in its presence. Just such a song as one written by Rodgers and Hammerstein for the distinguished production Carousel. You'll Never Walk Alone.
When you walk through a storm, keep your chin up high and don't be afraid of the dark. At the end of the storm is a gold sky and the sweet silver song of a lark. Walk on through the wind, walk on through the rain, though your dreams be tossed and blown. Walk on, walk on, with hope in your heart, and you'll never. Walk on through the rain, though your dreams be tossed and blown. Walk on, walk on, with hope in your heart. And you'll never walk alone. You'll never walk alone. You'll never.
Frank Sinatra. You know, folks, as Frank was singing You'll Never Walk Alone, I couldn't help but think how very much the lyrics of the song apply to every one of us. You remember the line, I'm sure, that go like this: walk on with hope in your heart, and you'll never walk alone. Well, that's the idea back of this program. We're not selling savings bonds just for the fun of selling savings bonds. What this program is selling is hope. Hope for a better life in the years to come. Hope for security. Hope for the realization of every one of our individual dreams. For every one of those dreams can be realized if you just save for it through the regular purchase of United States savings bonds. I buy them myself, and I recommend them to you as the safest, finest investment in the world today. You can buy them where you work, on a part payment basis through the payroll savings plan. Ask your boss about it. It's sure saving because it's automatic saving. Or if you're your own boss and not on a regular payroll, there's a special plan for you, too. It's the bond-a-month plan at your bank. So whichever plan fits your own situation, see about it right now. As the song says, it will put hope in your heart, and you will never walk alone. You have been listening to Guest Star, one of a series of transcribed feature programs brought you each week at this time by United States Savings Bonds and this station as a public service. Our guests today were Frank Sinatra and Axel Stordahl and the Hit Parade Orchestra. Thank you, Frank and Axel. It was a fine show. And friends, there'll be another fine guest star program for you next week, so watch for it. Meanwhile, this is your host, Les Tremaine, reminding you that you can be sure of a secure future if you invest regularly in United States savings bonds.
Frank Sinatra's guest on Guest Star from December of 1947. For our final show this week, let's listen to Hedda Hopper and her guest, Agnes Moorehead. This is from 1951.
Transcribed.
From Hollywood, NBC brings you Hedda Hopper. With tonight's news brought to life by Agnes Moorehead, Lori Sherry, and Danny Kaye. From the desk by the window looking right down on Hollywood and Vine, Hedda Hopper.
Hello, everybody. Nancy Olsen, Mrs. Alan Lerner, is expecting a baby. Elise and Tom Harmon expect their third child in August. The Leo Gossies' second child is due in May. Leo was a dead-end kid. Wild Bill Wellman, one of our most prolific directors, tells me his wife is anticipating a seventh child. Yes, it's spring, all right. Ingrid Bergman will soon be in the headlines again. Doris Day won't marry Patty Andrews' ex-husband, Marty Melcher, on April the 3rd, as announced. It's been indefinitely postponed. Reason Doris gives is that she's too busy making a picture. Could be that Rita Hayworth and Ali Khan are separating, but he says no. But then they said no about their marriage, and they said no again about their baby. Margaret Truman's acting appearance with Jimmy Stewart on radio is a prelude to a picture career. If she clicks on the air, she'll entertain offers from Hollywood. Bing Crosby's sunning himself at Palm Springs, and he's not alone. Bill Morrow's with him. Winston Churchill is trying to make up his mind whether he'll pay another visit to America. Orson Welles is on his way back to America with the belief that people have forgiven him for Macbeth. You know, it's quite a coincidence that Pat Neal was stopping at the same hotel as Gary Cooper in Havana, Cuba. I recently visited with Agnes Moorehead, one of the fabulous First Drama Quartet, whose reading performance of George Bernard Shaw's Don Juan in Hell has made theatrical history all across the nation. Well, this type of reading performance is nothing new for Agnes. She told me that her interest in it started when she first heard the late Edna St. Vincent Millay read her own poem, The Harp Weaver. And that's my item for tonight, a chance for Agnes Moorehead to read The Harp Weaver.
Son, said my mother when I was knee-high, you need of clothes to cover you, and not a rag have I. There's nothing in the house to make a boy breeches, nor shears to cut a cloth with, nor thread to take stitches. There's nothing in the house but a loaf end of rye, and a harp with a woman's head nobody will buy. And she began to cry. That was in the early fall. When came the late fall, so son, she said, the sight of you makes your mother's blood crawl. Little skinny shoulder blades sticking through your clothes. And where you'll get a jacket from, God above knows. It's lucky for me, lad, your daddy's in the ground and can't see the way I let his son go around. Oh. And she made a queer sound. That was in the late fall. When the winter came, I'd not a pair of breeches nor a shirt to my name. I couldn't go to school or out of doors to play, and all the other little boys passed our way. Son, said my mother, come climb into my lap, and I'll chafe your little bones while you take a nap. Oh, but we were silly for half an hour or more. Me with my long legs dragging on the floor, a rock, rock, rocking to a Mother Goose rhyme. Oh, but we were happy for half an hour's time. But there was I, a great boy, and what would folks say to hear my mother singing me to sleep all day in such a daft way? Men say the winter was bad that year. Fuel was scarce and food was dear. A wind with a wolf's head howled about our door, and we burned up the chairs and sat upon the floor. All that was left us was a chair we couldn't break, and the harp with a woman's head nobody would take for song or pity's sake. The night before Christmas, I cried with the cold. I cried myself to sleep like a two-year-old. And in the deep night, I felt my mother rise and stare down upon me with love in her eyes. I saw my mother sitting on the one good chair, a light falling on her from I couldn't tell where, looking 19 and not a day older. And the harp with a woman's head leaned against her shoulder. Her thin fingers moving in the thin, tall strings were weaving wonderful things. Many bright threads from where I couldn't see were running through the harp strings rapidly, and gold threads whistling through my mother's hand. I saw the web grow and the pattern expand. She wove a child's jacket, and when it was done, she laid it on the floor and wove another one. She wove a red cloak so regal to see. She's made it for a king's son, I said, and not for me. But I knew it was for me. She wove a pair of breeches quicker than that. She wove a pair of boots and a little cocked hat. She wove a pair of mittens. She wove a little blouse. She wove all night in the still, cold house. She sang as she worked, and the harp strings spoke. Her voice never faltered, and the thread never broke. And when I awoke, there sat my mother, with the harp against her shoulder, looking 19 and not a day older, a smile about her lips and a light about her head, and her hand in the harp string, frozen, dead, and piled up beside her and toppling to the skies with the clothes of a king's son. Just my size.
Thank you, Agnes Moorhead. That was so beautiful. Judy Garland was accompanied to New York by Sid Luft, but he didn't go to England with her. Lloyd's of London are flying a doctor over to examine Errol Flynn's back. They're trying to save that $2,400 a week they've been paying him since his injury. Bella Mesta will be in San Francisco the end of May to make a speech. I hope she won't choose how to give a party as her subject, because some of the greatest hostesses in the world live in that city. And incidentally, I'm flying to San Francisco on Tuesday to participate in the 58th anniversary of the National Council of Jewish Women. In our town, there's nothing as important as how Hollywood sells itself to the rest of the country. Our publicity. The other night, one of our biggest executives, Doris Sherry, vice president in charge of production at MGM, gave a speech to the independent screen publicists. Dory explained his recipe for improving our town's position in the public eye. He said we writers should soft-pedal the scandal and the dirt. Do I agree? I certainly do not.
Now, wait a minute, Hedda. If you were to agree with everything I said, and if I were to agree with everything you said, I probably wouldn't be on this program. However, let's agree to disagree agreeably, and let's first decide what we're going to disagree about. I did not ask that writers soft-pedal scandal and dirt. I merely ask that we make an effort to loud-pedal the accomplishments and achievements of the industry and of most of the people in it.
Well, isn't that distorting the truth? After all, a reporter's job is to report. And if people insist on getting into trouble...
Now, wait a minute. If people get into trouble, a moving picture industry council is all for the reporters reporting the incident exactly as it happened. A personality's conduct is his own responsibility. And I certainly would not pretend to ask the press to suppress anything. We only ask that reporters report some of the plus side and not magnify some of the minus side. For instance, if one of our personalities becomes involved in a hit-and-run case or any other crime, then he has broken the law, and that's legitimate bad news. But if he happens to be at a nightclub and is heckled into an argument, I don't think this is the sort of incident that is big enough news to push Korea off the front page.
Well, that's not the same subject, Dory. You're talking about false reporting.
Well, that's exactly what I talked about to the publicist. There are many stories that are printed only because of the fame of the people concerned. I don't say that this responsibility is the sole responsibility of the press. Very often, antiquated studio publicity notions create false impressions. America is essentially a moral country. And Hollywood, a moral city. We're just anxious to have more people know that.
Well, I'll agree with you on that. But why don't you make more pictures showing just that quality? Intruder in the Dust, for instance, may have been a small segment of the truth about America, but it didn't approach the whole truth. America's also essentially human. We love heroes. We adopt movie stars as our own. We're curious to know everything about them, not just half.
Well, that's exactly my point. We know there are plenty of good stories that would be colorful and glamorous enough to satisfy all the readers. We happen to believe that people are as interested in reading good things as they are bad.
Or see the good things on the screen as well as the bad.
Well, we know that it's perfectly human to be interested in stories about people's failings and mistakes. But I was told recently by a very prominent publisher of a national magazine that he devotes 16% of his copy to what we call plus news about Hollywood, and his circulation's increased by 1 million. I think that's a pretty good argument for our point of view.
Since we're talking about truth, Dory, how about picture advertising? For instance, take your picture, Battleground.
Mm-hmm.
Denise Darcel had only a bit in that picture, in some of the ads. The public was led to believe that she was more important than she actually was. Why do studios still use that old, stupendous, colossal type of advertising, with every picture advertised as being the greatest, and every movie ad with the girl fully undressed? Wouldn't you say that's the same old, false style of public relations?
Well, now, it would be ridiculous for me to say there have not been big errors in motion picture advertising. But this fall is not unique to the picture business. It's true of all businesses. Everybody uses extravagant terms to praise their own product, whether it's indigestion pills, motor cars, floor polish, cigarettes, or movies.
But these were salesmen, Dory, and obviously not seekers after the truth. As we are.
Well, you certainly have a point, truth in advertising. But let me ask you, how many people would buy the toothpaste that was advertised as, this is a nice toothpaste, smells pretty good, won't cure anything, won't get you married or make you a big success, but it isn't much worse than any of the others. Or, this is just another movie, not the greatest, but it should keep you occupied for an hour and 15 minutes.
Well, how many people are buying our pictures today,
Doctor? About 80 million a week.
Well, I had a letter last week from a small theater owner who said, you know, we bought this theater to support us. We ended up supporting the theater. But you still think that the greatest harm done to our industry is when big names are given unpleasant and often unnecessary publicity?
Well, of course. Generally, I have to say that's so.
Well, what about the headlines regarding communists in Hollywood?
Well, they certainly are big headlines. But I'm not too concerned if what finally emerges is the truth. Because the truth will show that there's a tiny small percentage of people who are communists. I'm sure no greater than in any other business or any other section of the country. As a matter of fact, only 100 out of 35,000 are under any cloud.
But ours is a peculiar business. You know and I know that we have the greatest medium for disseminating propaganda, good or bad, in the entire world. It's not just another industry. So what do you think about exposing or defending people like Larry Parks and the others?
Well, I believe that those who refuse to cooperate and refuse to answer the committee can solicit no support from the industry. Those who admit that they once were communist members but who have seen the light of day, well, that's up to the American public. The Daily Mirror in New York in an editorial says, Larry Parks has set a pattern for others in Hollywood. Let him have a square deal.
Okay. Now, I'd like to quote what I said in my column in the New York Daily News. 1, 2, or 10 careers in Hollywood aren't worth a dime unless we're willing to lose them for our country. Why so much emphasis on one career? I, for one, believe that the life of one soldier fighting for our freedom is worth more than all the careers in all of Hollywood.
Well, Larry's a public figure. I was going to say that Larry's a public figure, and certainly the public is going to make that decision. In the case of those individuals who were members of organizations that later became communist-controlled and then got out when they learned that, well, I think they deserve every support.
Yes, if they did get out.
The point is, let's get the truth. And with the truth, I think it is as important that the innocent be protected as it is that the guilty be punished.
Well, Dory, that's why I say we reporters should make public every scrap of evidence we can find. We shouldn't glorify or be soft-hearted about certain quick-change artists who don't sing Yankee Doodle until they're forced to, just one step ahead of the FBI. If, as you say, the actions of a few can blacken our entire industry, then our job is to weed them out just as fast as ever we can.
Well, certainly no one can be against telling the truth about any situation. In connection with that, I should like to say what a man named Maldini has said, and I quote, "In necessary things, unity. In doubtful things, liberty. In all things, charity."
And in an emergency such as we're in now, action. I still argue that it's urgent that these people be classified, and if they are Reds, then eliminated.
Well, I have an abiding faith in truth, and nothing ever stands in the way of it, ultimately and finally.
If we're talking about the truth, then I say the whole problem of publicity, then, is really up to everyone in Hollywood. It's up to the studios and the stars who must live up to their responsibilities.
Of course.
Because they have been so glorified by the American people.
It's up to everyone, even unglamorous executives. And the writers and columnists who report our town to the world. And that's about where I came in.
And the work has only just begun. We're both for truth and for better public relations. And thank you so much for coming, Dory.
Thank you, Anna.
Josephine Hull was the biggest hit of all the Academy winners. And the youngest Grammar girl, Marlena Dietrich. I was so certain that Jose Ferrer and Judy Holliday would win the two top awards that I offered to bet anybody in Hollywood $1,000 on it. I had no takers. But that doesn't mean I thought they were the best. I don't. Celeste Holm and Sam Jaffe were sitting in a New York cafe listening to the awards. When Jaffe lost to George Sanders, he said, "Well, that's that." Then Celeste lost to Josephine Hull. She turned to Jaffe and said, "Shall we dance?" Richard Basehart flew to London without studio permission to pop the $64 question to Valentina Cortesa. He came back a sadder and a wiser man. You know, I've always been a great admirer of Maurice Chevalier. I'm also a great fan of Danny Kaye. Well, when I saw 20th Century Fox's brand new picture On the Riviera, I really hit the jackpot. Because in this one, Danny out-chevaliers Chevalier. Listen.
If you look, you see the people from Paris playing on the Riviera. Grand as ice and snow, it's nice to needs to go where the moon clad alone is clearer. All the girls are gay and they parle français anytime, any place, any way. If you want another kiss but you don't think that you should on the Riviera, you would if you're just out to bust out and see what life can give. The place to live is the Riviera. You know, I tell you, why not come with me on the magic carpet of the motion picture to the playground of the world, Nice, which is just a stone's throw from Cannes, which is just a stone's throw from Monte Carlo, which is just a stone's throw from Gibraltar, which is just a stone. As we sail down the Mediterranean, our trip is uneventful, except our cameraman fall overboard. And our director, who have brought along his parents, develop bad case of mal de mer. He is sick of his mother. We disembark and go immediately to the most famous historic monument of the Riviera, the roulette table. And it is here we find the croupier, man with very bad cough. We express to him our sympathies, and he exclaims, merci, which means thank you. We reply, pas de tout, which means father of twins. Not to be confused with pas de deux, father of idiot twins. Pronounced du, du, du. And so we leave beautiful Hawaii and come back to the Riviera, where the girls are gay and they parle français anytime, any place, anyway. If today you have a million and tomorrow you're broke on the Riviera. Oh, big joke if you're just out to bust out and see what life can give. The place to live is the Riviera. Yeah, you know what I'd like to do, Head? I'd like to come on the show some afternoon and have an argument. You know, I always come on. I'm just a little minstrel boy who's singing songs and things. I'd really like to discuss something with you.
Well, I'd like to discuss anything with you. What should we discuss?
Well,
pick your subject.
All right. You know, being engaged in the motion picture business, I feel that those people, not as a group, but definitely, we have, as we sincerely believe...
Oh, definitely.
That I agree with that. If you were misled by advertising and somebody said, go in and see the picture, it doesn't smell bad, and the toothpaste you use will not be, do you honestly think, well, Hedda, I think we're too childish? Seriously, now. You know that in the last 10 years, pictures have really come of age. As far as musicals, I don't know anything about the other ones, but you remember musical pictures years ago?
I remember them 35 years ago, do you?
Well, goodbye. I remember pictures. When you saw one musical picture, you saw them all, you know. It didn't really matter. You walked in the theater, and if the woman in front did take her hat off and you did look at the screen, what did you see? Manic Depressive Pictures presents... Wow! Wow! Hello, Christmas! Produced by R.U. Manic and directed by Depressive. Now you know the name of the picture and you'd like to see it. But no. Screenplay by Gluck, from a stage play by Mutz, from a story by Blip, from a chapter by Ronk, from a sentence by Dokes, from a comma by Stokes, from an idea by Gropes, based on Joe Miller's jokes. Now you know the name of the picture and who wrote it, and you'd still like to see it,
but no. Art direction, Finkel Puff Interiors, Minerva Buff Photography, Alonzo Tech Recorded Sound, and Needle Back Upholstery by Zachary, Nick Nackery by Thackeray, Tipsickery by Dickery, and Dickery by Dot. Now, finally, at last, comes the picture. And what do we see? The same old beautiful chorus girls. The scene is a ranch in Fresno, California. So what are they singing? When it's cherry blossom time in Orange, New Jersey, we'll make a peach of a pear. I know we cantaloupe, so honey, do be mine. And this, up from the gulch rides a hunk of man. Here's our hero, Cowboy Dan, a galloping, yodeling buckaroo. His horse, of course, is a baritone, too. I've got the wagon wheels inside of me. I've got that old cactus in the hide of me. I've got that. The girls are delighted to hear this. But where is our heroine? As the bell rings for lunch, we find our heroine in the corral eating her heart out. She is Mary Sue Ann, tap-dancing daughter of an American juggling act who left on the doorstep of an old English castle where she was found by Sir Basil Metabolism, who said, by Jove, a girl baby! I shall raise her as my own daughter! Which he did. But she wants to marry Cowboy Dan, who she fell in love with, so she can tap-dance, but she knows Sir Basil, her father, will never permit this. Never, never, never! That's why she's eating her heart out. But through her tears, she is singing a happy little song because she is also a coloratura soprano. Beside herself. Her favorite position.
Oh, Father, you must let me marry Cowboy Dan. He owns the biggest ranch in Texas, bar none.
Bar none? Why, that's the password of the FBI. It can't be.
No, no, yes, yes, no, no, yes, yes, no, no, yes, yes, no, no, yes, yes, it can't be. But it was. He rushes to Mary Sue Ann. Mary Sue Ann, you must help me out. Can you tap out a message in code? This is her big chance. Now she can tap dance, which she does. But what has she done? She has betrayed her own father. But he isn't her father. He is heimlich mein Schlupen, mein Gottes verloben Haus, die Knöbe, der Heldenskneis, als die Heldenskneis, als die Knöbe, die Knöbe, der Heldenskneis, all am die Knöbe, hol, hol. Junior. Stick up your hands, you dirty rat, and go out of flight, and I can laugh. Ah, the FBI finally captured the German spy, Dan and Mary, about to blame you through the pictures of our hands. But no. Who ever heard of a musical picture without Carmelita Pepita, the Bolivian bombshell? I wish you would come with me to my little village in Bolivia. So peaceful there are the purple mountains, with the shining stars and the little sky. And the little people who live so simple and quiet. And every night, all they want to do is grab a partner, swing away, share about time and hours and days. Grab about the teeth and swing about the hair, and you will make a peach of a pear. Grab!
So here we are back in Fresno, California, and this is where you came in. But do not fret, my friends. This is a picture that ends in the middle for the benefit of the people who came in the middle. This is the
God, we still have our Danny Kays, and we still laugh in America. They don't laugh in Russia.
week, NBC will again bring you Hedda Hopper with Hollywood news brought to life by the Andrews sisters, a provocative discussion with Richard Carlson, and a dramatic highlight with Charles Boyer.
Good night, everybody.
Hear Hedda Hopper next Sunday, right after Phil Harris. And in just a moment, hear Theater Guild starring Walter Pidgeon and Signe Hasso in The Fallen Idol. The Hedda Hopper Show is produced by FMB, with direction by Gil Faust, music by Frank Worth. This is Art Baker bidding you good night.
This program is transcribed. Three chimes mean good times on NBC. Coming up next, it's The Fallen Idol, starring Walter Pidgeon and Signe Hasso on the Theater Guild on the air. And for adventure in the modern-day Wild West, hear Joel McRae tonight as he stars in Tales of the Texas Rangers, authentic stories of the nation's oldest police force. Now, hear The Fallen Idol on Theater Guild on NBC.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan, thanking you for listening.